Welcome back to Tasteland. I am Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Aliotto.
And Daisy, who are we speaking with today?
Today we're speaking with Julia Black. She's a tech and business correspondent at Vanity Fair. Recent move, by the way. So excited to talk about that. Her work has been published in the New York Times, MIT Technology Review, Wired, The Verge, and many others that you would know. She formerly worked at Insider, where she broke news about powerful figures like Dave Portnoy and Elon Musk. One may be more powerful than the other.
who knows? Hard to say.
She also worked at The Information, where she wrote a lot of features investigations about the tech industry's role in shaping politics, which is extremely relevant this week, and we'll definitely get into that.
Yes, looking forward to getting into that. Daisy, something I have to ask you about. On Twitter the other day, you posted a picture of firemen in your apartment. What was that about?
Yeah, so I heard them like coming up in the hallway. Like I heard commotion that sounded like EMTs. And my upstairs neighbor is like a little bit elderly. So I opened the door and I was like, hey, is Tony okay? And they were like, Tony's fine, but he thought that he smelled gas. And I was like, well, I didn't smell anything, but you know, you can come in. And so like five guys, like one of them holding an axe, just start traipsing through. And like my apartment was like a mess.
Traipsing even.
I just thought it was funny that there were so many of them. So I got like, I was like, oh, I got to get a pic of this. But I was trying to be inconspicuous. So what I ended up getting was like this lovely picture of like the back of one fireman and then like another fireman disappearing around the corner, which was like so ambiguous.
I don't think it's impolite. They're in your apartment.
That's true. So it was so like not a big issue, but I thought it was a funny photo. So
yeah. I mean, it piqued my interest enough to remember it a week later.
It was a little, so. I was microdosing a little bit of drama. There was no gas situation as far as I'm aware of. I thought you were going to ask me about Tasteland's industry cameo, but I guess the fireman in my apartment is more interesting.
Much more interesting. Well, okay, So here's the soapbox. Step on it. Industry.
Okay, well, no.
I have not started the new season yet. I'm behind.
Well, I think we should step on it together because Tasteland has achieved new heights.
Yes.
Something that I said in was it episode 7?
Tasteland could be nominated for an Emmy if you really think about it.
Yeah,
property.
Guys. Tasteland, credited writer on HBO's Industry. something that I said in our conversation with Mickey and Conrad in September 2024 became a line on Industry. And I will say, like, I don't remember everything that I've ever said. I had recently reread the transcript because we ran the interview ahead of the season. And so
when he said the line,
yeah, I mean, I was pointing at the screen like meme style. Like I paused it and I was like, wait a minute. It was the perfect Easter egg because they said nothing to me about this. And I haven't even said anything directly to them, although they liked my post about it. And so did the actor.
In America, your story begins when you start telling it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're welcome. Thank you. Like, I loved it. I think great artists definitely are stealing things all the time. And I don't even consider it stolen. I think it's great. And I'm so happy that Tasteland episode will have a lifetime beyond, you know, this podcast. So
as long as Industry stands. And the gears.
Yeah, we've achieved immortality, guys. So this will be our last episode. I'm just kidding. yeah, so that was super exciting. And the other thing I wanted to tell you, I thought of you this morning. So Dirtbooks has like some advisors who are volunteers, and I wanted to do something nice to them. Nice for them to
for
thank them.
Nice to them.
No, too many of them. I wanted to do something nice to thank them. So I said, can I take you all to dinner in New York? Mm-hmm. And there's five of them. So there's six of us and a couple of them are vegan or vegetarian. So my goal was like, I'm going to try to get a reservation at Sema, which is a one Michelin star Southern Indian restaurant that has had a lot of great accolades. I've never been there.
Me neither. Mm-hmm. I had a reservation once, but I ended up not going. Anyways.
West or East? Oh, yeah, I guess West.
It's in the West Village.
And they have really good vegan and vegetarian options. Mm-hmm. So I was like, this is my goal, right? And the reservations open like whatever amount of days in advance, maybe like 10.
You're resi sniping.
Yeah, but this is like the first time maybe ever that I've like sat on resi and waited for 9 o'clock to hit refresh and grab the res.
Which I did talked about doing. Yeah.
We've talked about doing. I did a dry run yesterday. This is how serious I was about it. Because I was like,
a dry run.
ABCV is the fallback. ABCV is like Old Faithful, lovely meal, great ambiance, but it's not as buzzy, right? Mm. And I really like, I want this to be special, right? So I did a dry run yesterday because it's for the 11th. The 11th didn't open until today. So yesterday, the 10th opened. I sat on there at 9 a.m. I refreshed and I saw, okay, how fast do I need to be? Then that was the dry run. So then today, when the 11th opened, sat, refreshed, did the whole thing. And I got it. So I was like really happy, but I was like, I feel like Francis. And I was like, you would have to be kind of addicted to the adrenaline of doing this to do it because it like kind of sucks and is like not practical at all.
It does. No, it's terrible because you have to take time out of your day to do it. I have not done that for quite some time.
Like I had to set an alarm so I wouldn't forget. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, but no, I'm excited.
I've done the alarm. There's times where it was like for a birthday, whether it was mine or my fiance's, where I was like, oh, there's like one or two restaurants I would love to, this is a great excuse to go. And then I'm just spending like 2 days trying to do that. Anyways, I hope you have a great time at SEMA. I've been to Damaka.
Is that the sister restaurant? Yeah.
Previous.
I also never went quite there.
Good. It's quite good. But yeah, SEMA seems to be a little more posh.
Well, the other reason I was
being not in Essex Market, being its own building for one.
Right. Well, I did receive an invitation from one Matt Rodbard to come back on the Taste podcast. So I feel like I need to accumulate some recent food and restaurant experiences and stories because I'm kind of boring. I go through long periods of culinary boringness, especially this weekend where I was snowed in with like a bag of oranges and some sandwiches. So
being snowed in was great. I went to the local bakery in the morning. I got a loaf of bread. My friend made split pea soup. I went over there. I made beans.
Giving Michael Clayton.
Great movie. Anyways, Julia is here, so let's go talk to her. You wrote 3 pieces on embryo selection. I don't know if they're all published last year, but like over the last couple of years, certainly. I think the most recent one was in October. I learned a term, pre-implantation genetic testing for polygenic traits, which, if I'm understanding this right, is essentially the scientific term for eugenics, which I guess is also a scientific term, but more like of a positive.
Wow, Francis is really coming in hot.
Some would argue. Yes. It's such messy terminology. I mean, I've had so many editors struggle with like, oh, isn't there an easier way we can say it? But like, if you want to be technically correct, yeah, that's what it is. You're testing the genes of 5-day-old embryos, but yeah, pre-implantation genetic testing for polygenic traits.
Is the only way to do that, potentially stupid question, is the only way to do that if you're doing like IVF and the embryo spends time outside of your body, or can people do that if the embryo is like it never leaves your body?
Yeah, so definitely for, I mean, obviously pre-implantation refers to pre-IVF implantation, mm-hmm. but it is interesting. As a pregnant woman now, I'm having this experience of there is quite a lot of genetic testing kind of built into the pregnancy process that is standard these days. At like 10 weeks, you do a lot of genetic testing. So no one's doing that for polygenic traits, as far as I know, which are like these complex like personality traits and rare diseases and things. But you do get a pretty comprehensive scan for single gene disorders, like all these things, which, I mean, basically what that means is it gives you an option to terminate a pregnancy. Mm. But if you're testing a bunch of embryos for IVF, you get to pick the best one. So yeah, genetic testing is happening kind of across the board at this point, but to varying degrees and with different options for what to do with it.
Is this something accessible to normal people? From reading your work, this is more of like the super rich are doing it? Like, what is the spectrum of like this being science fiction to more like reality for certain groups of people?
Yeah. I mean, right now it costs up to $50,000, and that's on top of IVF, which is already like $20,000+ probably. So no, I mean, it's not at all accessible. Obviously that's kind of always the argument for technology, is there's these like early adopters who get access to a product or a technology that is very expensive, and then it can get more funding, and then it can get cheaper, and there's more competition, and there's more market for it. And, you know, like, it's funny, genetic testing itself, which of course like was brought to us by the Human Genome Project. I don't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, but like initially to test a single individual genome, it costs like $1 billion worth of research. And then today you can get consumer genetic testing for like a couple $100. So, you know,
is that because they're using AI as part of the sequencing process?
That's a really good question. And I've like always kind of assumed that AI would play more of a role in all this, but AI does not seem to be like the breakthrough technology here.
I can see though a startup landscape where people are going to kind of like hedge on the ability to sequence your own genome at home, like using some of these technologies.
You mean?
I mean, like Theranos type stuff for like genome sequencing using AI.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because like the whole longevity. There's a will, there's
a way. Are you pitching, Julia? Are you trying to raise money right now, Daisy?
Yeah.
There's a market for it. I mean, the Brian Johnsons of the world, and like, frankly, Elizabeth Holmes making a comeback from prison. Mm-hmm.
Somebody needs to take away
like
her
consumer
phone.
I don't understand the logistics of how that's working. I have like DM'd her, and she's liked things that I've sent, but never responded.
Okay, she can keep her phone. I mean, if she's riding with you, it's fine then.
Yeah, that's what it's all about.
But you're allowed to have your phone in prison if you're liking my tweets. That's my rule.
Yes. Thank you, Elizabeth Holmes, for your likes. But no, I can't tell if I'm communicating with her lawyer or her directly, or does she have a burner phone, in which case surely they know about it. I don't know. I would love to tell that story. Although journalists are very...
low security thing.
Yeah, exactly. She's not considered dangerous. Maybe she should be.
Speaking of dangerous, Francis and I have not recorded a podcast episode since the Substack TV announcement. And I was thinking about that in the context of your story about TBPN, you know, whether Substack's going to try to woo some of the stuff that started off as like Twitter native to the platform. From my perspective, there's going to be a lot of competition because YouTube already exists, has a lot of volume. And also recently, I saw a headline that they've surpassed Reddit for certain types of searches. So that's going to be like a tough thing to compete with. But I was pretty sure when I saw that the Chernin Group invested in Substack that this was going to be something that they were going to require them to go after, because that's always sort of been their MO, like pushing scale really hard and competition. I'm going to be honest, I don't really see it happening for them.
I mean, it's funny that you bring up TBPN because, you know, if you read my piece, like kind of against my own best interest, I love TBPN. Like they totally won me over. I think they're doing a really good job. And everyone's like, why do you like them? You shouldn't like them. And to put my finger on it, like what I like is that it's very organic. These guys are clearly having fun. They come from this world that, you know, you can't replicate the relationships they have. You can't replicate so many things that make their show watchable. And yet you've seen so many other business media platforms try to replicate almost like to a T this exact formula. And it's sad to watch. You know, they kind of called out, there was like 7 competitors who've launched like straight up copycats, and they're not working. So yeah, I mean, I think the same kind of applies. Like these like media boardrooms are always like pointing at one very organic success story and being like, well, why don't we just copy paste that? And I don't think it tends to work. Yeah, I don't know. I will not be watching Substack TV, sorry to say.
I've been on one Substack Live, our friend of the pod, Ben Dietz, his Sick Talk show. And as somebody who we're recording on Riverside right now, right? That's the software we use. And I think quite a large portion of the podcast market uses Riverside to record. What was weird, this was, I don't know, 3 months ago or something like that. What was weird about using the Substack Live app is you have to do it in the Substack app on your phone. And, you know, I have a nice microphone here, a nice camera that I use to podcast. And then I was just kind of having to use my phone and the lighting was weird. The audio is bad. I'm having to use my AirPods to record the audio, which low audio quality. Everything about it was a horrible, and you know, obviously I always should say I do work for Beehive. So maybe I'm a little biased, but
that's going to have to change though. Like they're going to have to choose between optimizing everyone into the app by brute force and optimizing the Substack TV product, and they're going to have to make it available on desktop. There's no way.
They
will. Way.
And I think they have. I think they since have. Yeah. But it was a horrible UX for me as the recorder, for the audience having to listen to a lower quality product. Maybe it's easier for Ben being the guy who is hosting the video, right? It's very easy to just turn it on, record it, publish it. Like that's all kind of automated. But I think that's the wrong user to optimize for, because the Substack customer is ultimately the consumer, the reader, the subscriber, right? Like that's how they make their money. So I thought that was odd. I mean, it's more in doing this, they're trying to compete with YouTube, right? Like that's
right. Well, and according to the Hollywood Reporter, God, according to the Hollywood Reporter, Netflix is much more worried about Instagram right now, which I thought was very interesting.
Because they have the TV app now too.
Yeah.
That doesn't even make sense to me, and that makes way more sense than the Substack TV app. But like, I want to look at Instagram Reels when I've got.
No, you want to look all the time. You're a
okay.
Admitted
we talked about that last time.
I mean, the only thing I would add to that is like, I think that the best thing, like the most successful Substacks, are truly, truly a bunch of nerds. Like, if you look at like the top list, like these are not people who need to be on camera, if you will. And I say that as someone who does not typically do well on camera. Like, I don't know. It just seems like the wrong, you know. Like,
I mean, Francis and I don't want to be on data. Camera and, like, look at us, we're gorgeous.
I leave it to the pros. But, yeah, like, I don't know. I won't name names, but the Substackers I enjoy who also are really, like, high on the bestseller lists are not people who I think will thrive in this environment, so. I don't know. I'm a big fan of like staying in your lane.
one last word on TBPN too, and you get into this in your piece, and I think I saw a Joe Weisenthal tweet that summed it up pretty well too. Maybe somebody else, but that they're like, you know, they may be part of this industry, invested in some of the companies that they have on, like so meshed up in it that it could not be further from like journalistic objectivity, right? But one, like that's sort of a new norm. Like you need both, you need like journalistic objectivity, but independent creators like that, a lot of the ones I've interviewed on my other podcasts, like they talk about like the ability to like own their biases and put those like front and center in their work as like a big appeal for them in going independent, and a big appeal for their audience and coming for them, because it's more like it's stated. There's always some sort of bias when it's stated there. People like it. But also like I think there's a quote in your piece where they say how they have a stake in the tech industry becoming a better version of itself because they're having kids and they're thinking about that and how they want this. They want the tech industry to be better than it is. So I don't know. I can't speak to who they were like before they started doing this show, and I don't watch it. Like I'll tune in every now and then if I'm scrolling Twitter and it's on, but they seem to be becoming ever more critical and journalistic in their approach. And you wrote about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at the show, which is now almost a year and a half old, they've changed a lot. Their approach has evolved a lot. I really appreciate that they are open. In fact, it is part of the bit that they are sellouts. Like they're not denying that. They get these sponsorships. They are wearing the brands like
NASCAR style.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, the TBPN hats and exactly. They're in their F1 gear, sponsored by their own friends, and they'll interrupt, you know, they interrupted me like 50 times to be like, yeah, but have you considered switching to Ramp? Like it's part of the bit. So I actually really appreciate that. Meanwhile, there is another competitor of theirs, a well-known like tech show who I just learned does pay to play. Her guests pay her significant sums of money in order to appear on her podcast.
Molly.
And that is, you said it, I didn't.
It's got to be Molly. I know. Well,
and, you know, that's the kind of thing you should be transparent about. Mm-hmm. And it goes a long way to explain the way that those interviews go.
I'm wearing a green rugby, actually, by pure coincidence. I'm wearing my most Technology Brothers coded clothing item.
I can get mine out.
It's my high school. It's my high school field hockey rugby. It's probably one of the oldest items of clothing I own, and I'll never get rid of it. But even though my last name's like fading off the back. Actually, as you're saying that, I started percolating on a theory, and it's like, I wonder, I have to think about how true this might be, but I feel like if you come into journalism in the format of opinion or interviewing and you come in neutral, you end up more radicalized. Like, they came in very neutral. I think that they're probably getting radicalized more towards a general skepticism the more people they talk to and the more BS or book talking that they consume, because ultimately it's like you consume a ton of people's statements and you start to be able to pattern match, wait, this is how often people are kind of like full of shit. But if you come in with a certain ideology, like maybe like somebody like a Barry Weiss, think about like she was more ideological when she started out. Definitely not around stuff that most of the stuff she was more ideological around don't track with my beliefs. But I think you end up sanded down to be more neutral when you come in as like a Barry. But I also think people can ping pong. Like Tucker Carlson, he's definitely ping ponged between those roles throughout his career.
He's ping-ponging between like the spirit realm and planet Earth. So
yeah, I mean, really. Tucker, step away from the peptides. But
the Zen help him commune with the spirits, actually.
It's the same thing that happens to like people who are politicians, and like once you get a certain degree of power, you are and you're inside the government and you are dealing with the critics that are outside of the apparatus, it changes you because you have to see all of the roadblocks to perfection of your ideology. And like everyone now at this point anticipates it. Like Zoran Mamdani, he's not going to be a radical mayor because he can't. Now he's inside the power apparatus. Mm-hmm. I think there's a similar thing with journalists. Like the way that you operate on the fringe versus the way that you operate when you get proximity to power is different. But I think like proximity to power doesn't necessarily mean that somebody is going to become more of a sellout. I actually think that you can become less of a sellout if you're exposed to enough, kind of enough hypocrisy and kind of end up ping-ponging back the other way.
Yeah, maybe Barry Weiss will end up lived out after all her proximity to power, not her, and hypocrisy. I don't know.
Not her.
I mean,
are you writing about her? Have you written about her?
I have not written about her. It is interesting. She did follow me after I published the TBPN thing. So that was, she's the.
Does Mark Andreessen follow you?
No, but he does block me.
He followed and unfollowed me real quick.
Yeah.
That was not long for this world.
He does that.
Speaking of like blocking and censorship, what the heck is going on with TikTok? Because I'm seeing a lot of like anecdotal stuff about certain words being blocked or like, reach being throttled. But when I went in just as like an individual, I was like, it's really buggy right now. And that's why like nobody can see the videos. But like, where is there any sort of like concrete evidence emerging that there's a rhyme or reason to
this? Is in the context of, I think it was on, was it on Saturday that the ownership formally transferred over?
That sounds right.
It was a few days ago, as we record
the Saturday New York Times paper edition, which I still read. I think this is the problem with stories that unfold live in real time online on Twitter or wherever. Like, I had people asking like, oh, are you going to write about this? And first of all, I don't love doing quick turnarounds like that. But also I was kind of like, this story needs to unfold further because we just don't know. I'm seeing now more evidence that, you know, the NFL, which normally every TikTok video they post has like 6 million views, had zero views on the videos they posted this weekend. So that's probably not censorship. That actually would lend credence to the idea that this was some kind of like outage caused by the trip. So like, yeah, sometimes Occam's razor just really, you know, it's like, it's not always the conspiracy. Sometimes it's just the boring explanation, and the public has become more and more conspiracy minded. And I tweeted kind of like, oh, I saw one creator claim that she was blocked for mentioning ICE. Has anyone else seen anything? That's about as far as I'm willing to go in terms of like taking, you know, this also happened with that like AI generated DoorDash critique.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if you caught this, but like,
I knew that was cap from the beginning.
I mean, but the thing about like conspiracies like that, that turn out to be fake, is like, it's also true. There's there's like a massive grain of truth to it, because all of the things in the post were true. Like, I've spoken to DoorDash employees. That's how the company operates. It's so like, if something turns out to be AI generated, our perception of truth is just
with the TikTok thing too. It was like the stated goal of this acquisition to make it that, you know, China was not controlling this algorithm, and that like American interests could control it. So like, whether or not they're controlling it to this precise end, like, that was the goal of this acquisition, was so American interests could control TikTok. Like, like, whether or not this is the, this is the exact permutation of that, like, that's not a conspiracy. That was a stated goal.
Yeah. The broad strokes themes can be true and the specifics not. But this is why, like, real journalism remains so important, because the New York Times is never going to publish that first draft version of the story.
Yeah.
They're going to make sure that they have it airtight, and then you can rely on the fact that once it appears there, like, it's confirmed. It's not speculative tweeting or
even last night when I saw The Atlantic publish like that Bovino was out, I was like, okay, who else has this? Like, I was waiting for somebody else to confirm it. Whereas like, for some people, it's like, if that's in The Atlantic, that is like God's truth. And I'm at the point where it's like, if it's only in one of the major newspapers, it's not God's truth yet to me.
Yeah.
I
mean, and some things will never, and it's never going to be God's truth, like WMDs, you know, it's, you know.
No one's infallible, but you know, like, I heard from a source at OpenAI last night that Sam Altman had put out an internal statement about Minnesota. This person was like willing to quote for me, but wasn't willing to send screenshots because I guess OpenAI monitors those things. So I had this from one source. I went to all my other OpenAI sources. No one is getting back to me. I was like, oh, I really want to tweet this. I really want to like put this in a story. And I just didn't, because one source who doesn't even have screenshots is not enough. New York Times published it today. You know, it's frustrating to see. I would have loved to get that scoop. But like, you know, most, the idea is supposed to be that like a tenured and professional journalist will not jump straight to going live with it.
Right.
Like,
the important thing is that you didn't compromise your integrity.
Yeah.
And I mean, speaking of integrity, like, I saw you're in the process of working on and writing about the tech lash that's happening right now in your newsletter at Vanity Fair, which is voicier than some of the work that you were able to do at The Information. And I think, to Francis's point, like, is sort of like what the media apparatus right now requires, like the ability to be able to foreground your own perspective, but and not hide it behind this veneer of objectivity. But, you know, for the uninitiated, there was a lot of the right adjacent tech industry that went all in for Trump in a sort of mercenary way, like primarily with the argument being around economics, being around, you know, wanting to be post-woke, liking certain types of immigration, but not other types of immigration, depending on how well it suited them. And, you know, we have come there. I mean, there's been a lot of moments of reckoning in this term, but the murder of Alex Pretty was really like this breaking point where, for the first time in the term, we're seeing like, not scolding. I actually don't agree with scolding. Like, I don't agree with like publicly going to somebody and saying like, make a statement right now. I think like, if you want somebody to make a statement, you should have the consideration and respect to message them privately and say, like, it would be really great to see you speak on this at the very least. But there's a dynamic that I really haven't seen in Trump's first term yet of people really paying attention to who is silent and viewing that silence as a complicity or at least like a tacit acceptance of what's happening. And I have not seen the tech industry be this loud about politics in a very sort of like earnest way in a long time. And so, I mean, obviously you're writing about it. You don't have to give away everything that you're going to write about or say, but I'm curious, like, what's different about it this time from your perspective, from what you're seeing and from the people that you're talking with?
Yeah. I mean, we will see how long any of this lasts, but it really strikes me as a notable vibe shift. As tired as that phrase is, this is like the moment for it. Which, of course, the swing to the right was also a vibe shift that turned out to be pretty short-lived. I guess this visual of Alex Priddy was so intense and triggering. I mean, I know when I saw that video, I was like in complete shock. That said, it is a little surprising to me that this is the thing. I think that it also happens in the context of like support has been slipping around tariffs and, you know, even the markets, which, as you point out, like ultimately this was kind of a craven play for positive economics, and like the market started to get a little shaky this fall. And I think some people's faith started to flag. But yeah, you're not only seeing these like public statements now from leaders in the space, including some fairly notable ones. I mean, the Anthropic CEO yesterday made a statement. None of the other AI chiefs. And as I mentioned, Sam Altman made an internal statement that was pretty wishy-washy. But, you know, Vinod Khosla, Reid Hoffman, all those usual suspects. Yeah, that feels notable. And then I also have been kind of chatting with my sources on the right more privately and been pretty struck by the tone shift there. They're kind of saying, like, we can't really stand behind this administration anymore. This isn't working. Check back in 2028. Like, that's the vibe is, you know... For me, that New York Magazine cover story a year ago, that like the cruel kids table.
Oh, yeah.
That sort of felt like the peak of this like cultural dominance of the right. And it was one of those peaks where, you know, it's the peak and it's kind of like, oh, this is immediately going to become cringe. And so, yeah, I guess like a year later, that's kind of played out. Like the mood is not as celebratory. I was even at a like right-wing party this fall. I think it was September, where it was a pretty mixed mood, you know, a lot of talk about lawfare. That was kind of their main focus. But I was in conversations about J.D. Vance where people were like, this guy is not it. And that was, these were like true Trump believers. These were people who wanted like third Trump term. But like J.D. Vance is not turning out to be this legacy prospect that he was clearly handpicked for. So yeah, the confidence is really flagging pretty quickly after like so much golden age talk and so much like landslide victory. So I don't know. I think for that to happen within a year is pretty striking. And now it's like, what happens for the next 3 years? We still have so much more.
I think unfortunately a lot of people and the internet kind of fuels this mentality. Know how to create a referendum on the status quo, but they don't know how to offer an alternate vision of the future. And the whole, like, tech's whole thing is offering a compelling vision of the future. But when you really look at the benchmarks for what's been achieved in AI and other recent developments, there's been some amazing scientific breakthroughs. There's been amazing, like, health breakthroughs. But they don't come really from the heart of Silicon Valley. And there is a failure to, I think there's been a failure to offer a compelling vision of the future that is like organically of Silicon Valley and these top kind of, I guess it's not Fang anymore, it's Mango, I recently learned, like these mango companies. So while that's flagging, it's like at the same time that's flagging, these really loud voices get super into politics and offering a compelling vision of the political future. But it really was just like a referendum on Biden and the status quo. And Bidenism was never even a really a distinct thing. It was kind of just like they kind of got sucked into a referendum on liberalism in general. And like, guess what? Liberalism's popular for a reason. The average person likes liberalism. They just don't like certain aspects of the Democratic Party, which like, who does? And yeah. I would say the same thing about the left. Like, there are people on the left who are very good at critiquing and creating a referendum around the status quo. And that's really important, but it's not the same as being able to govern or hold power or be responsible with power. And the internet just, it incentivizes dissatisfaction with the status quo. But the right, the left, and the tech industry, especially since that's who we're talking about, need to get a lot better at actually offering substance.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I don't remember much from college, but I do remember I took a Latin American history class and I had this assignment. It was like an in-class sit-down assignment and the professor was like, summarize modern Latin American history in one sentence. And I was crowned the winner because it was something that was like, it's a pendulum swing between like right-wing authoritarianism and populism. I don't know. I guess it was perfectly concise. And like what that is like, that's like the sign of a failed state. Like America has now entered that period where, yeah, we're going to get these like pendulum swings between right and left. And like all that really signifies is instability. And, you know, when everyone's a reactionary, it's true. You're not like standing for something. You're just reacting against, and not a productive way to run a nation, as we are finding out. So, you know, the center is starting to look pretty good.
Well, and venture capital is fundamentally a reactionary business model, but the returns on those decisions are very far out. And that is almost the opposite of like what government is, like, or what good government should be. Like, good government is like decisions that are made not as a reaction to something, that are where you see the return on a relatively like short-term basis. And VC is the opposite. Every decision is reactionary and the consequences are so far out that like I could understand why somebody who's had their brain pickled by that business model for so long just does not live in the same reality as the rest of us. But like, you know, for the rest of us, it's like, if you can't afford your rent tomorrow or you can't like afford your groceries tomorrow, the consequences are immediate. And that's where, obviously, that's where populism comes from, when you have that like huge disconnect. But I do think, just to circle back, that this current backlash and discourse indicates that the roots of liberalism are deeper in the lives of normal people and their conception of what it means to be American than the loudest voices would want you to believe.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you caught that hilarious tweet from Katie Miller where she misunderstood Anthropic CEO Dario Amodei's usage of the term classical liberalism to mean wokeism. And it's like, clearly there's some misfiring and misjudgment on behalf of the administration for how much like core values like that do matter across the political spectrum and how much, you know, the Constitution still matters to people.
Well, and also how symbolic people are in their politics, especially the generation above us. Like, I think there was a lot of criticism of pink pussy hats and holding up a sign or wearing a pin or putting a Ukrainian flag on your house from people who are like kind of Gen X and younger. But like, I think if you are older, like those symbols really mean something to people. And I think that came out a lot around the demolition of the East Wing. It's like, that was sort of a breakthrough moment for some people. And it's like, well, how's that your line? But a lot of people are very symbolic in their thinking. And they haven't had their brains pickled by how mimetic the internet is. And like, you know, memes on the internet are kind of like the opposite of having a stable symbol. Like anything can mean anything. It's like Dadaism, right? Yeah. Like 6-7, it's 6-7. It's something that's signified by itself. But for people who are like of the older generation, like if somebody puts like a yellow ribbon on their tree because their neighbor is overseas fighting and they want them to come home, that means something. It's a big deal. It's not a meme. And there's a big divide there around like symbols. And I think people are realizing that there's, especially like the JD Vances who've kind of embraced like full millennial cringe Dadaism, like whoever's running the Homeland Security Twitter account, they're like underestimating the stability of symbols in a large part of the American populace, that like for some people, a certain visual still means something. The White House as a physical entity still means something.
You're talking about symbols in terms of like generations a little bit too, but it's really just about like, I think it's less about the generational divide than like the online to not online spectrum, right? The more online you are, the more used you are to the rapid pace of images and like to the fluidity of meaning. Whereas if you're not online, meaning is a little more rigid to you and you're not so used to rapid proliferation of images that just kind of flash before you without, and you become numb to them.
You're right. It's not a perfect correlation.
No, but it's part of it, right? So it's like, I'm just thinking of like my sister who's not very online. And like, I think to her, symbols would mean a lot more to her than they do to me spending my entire life looking at the screen.
But also like what underlies those symbols, and you can't just have an American flag for the sake of an American flag. Like it's not just a pattern that gets printed on a bikini at a barbecue. Like it means something. And I think most people haven't spent the time reading things like Project 2025 or Curtis Yarvin manifestos or the things that really have intellectually.
Or his shitty palm in that one outlet journal.
Yeah. Like this fringe stuff that actually has been incredibly intellectually informative to key people in the administration, which is fundamentally anti-American, anti-constitution, like what these documents have literally argued for is dismantling the Constitution. Yeah. So I don't know. It may seem fringe, but like if you talk to high level administration officials as I have about what they've read over the last 10 years, like, yeah, there's nothing American about it.
I saw this X article yesterday. I don't read a lot of X articles, but I read this one. It was
an abomination.
The author was presumably a young founder in Silicon Valley. All I remember is in his bio, it said like YC Winter 24 batch or something like that. So presumably a young founder.
Like but it was this, for him to be.
It was this really earnest, I don't know, 900 word article about how the tech aligning themselves, or tech as an industry aligning itself with this administration and with right wing politics is bad. And I won't recount the whole thing, but basically he was making this pendulum argument you were talking about, Julia, where like this just like he was saying, like, I'm in tech because I am an effective accelerationist and I believe in technological process being good for humanity. And I want to be part of that. And I want to drive that progress. And I want to make humanity more advanced and more powerful through technology. And in this very earnest way it was written, right? And he was saying that tech aligning itself with this administration and with right-wing politics is just bad because it will then erode public trust in tech and then make the next administration, again, just this reactive thing we're talking about, where then it's just going to like make it so tech gets regulated into a point where progress is impossible. And I found it sort of touching in that, like, I don't always see that sort of earnesty, especially on Twitter. But yeah, there was this comment that was a reply to it too, that framed 2020 as being Dems plus tech versus Republicans, then 2024 being Republicans plus tech versus Dems. And then that 2028 will be Republicans plus Dems versus tech, which I don't know how that pans out and how they're, maybe it's just populism against tech. And the last thing here too, do you think that people think of tech and VC as being the same thing, or do they just think of tech and VC as part of tech? like your average person who's not very online?
I think they probably should see them as the same thing. I mean, different roles in the ecosystem, but they're pretty aligned. Though, Daisy, I think your point about like the incentives of VC and tech are so misaligned from what the incentives of government should be. So like reason number 362, why tech should not be running the government.
I mean, like, Doge was a failure, right? Like what did Doge?
It really was. And that's someone's
some
like
social
again,
security numbers.
Yeah. Like, and I have spoken with people who were very pro Doge who admit that it's a failure. So yeah, I mean, great. You got your year and it's a failed experiment. Unfortunately, now there's three more years to pick up the pieces. I genuinely don't know what we do with that, but very striking week in terms of admission of failure so far. And either, I mean, I think a lot of tech people are hoping that the administration will course correct. You know, you have like Jason Calacanis out there being like, Trump will fix this and return us to the golden age. And like, all he has to do is fire Stephen Miller. And like, sure, firing Stephen Miller would be a start. But I think part of the problem with how tech sees all this is that they're unwilling to acknowledge how intrinsically tied it all is. It's like, you know, people were like, oh, like just work on AI and don't talk about politics. That's an absurd claim. Like AI is incredibly political, could not be more political. And I appreciated that about Dario's essay yesterday, acknowledging that like, you know, if you are concerned about democracy, like you have to be concerned about AI development. And we're seeing with like surveillance tools, with how Doge like used AI databases for its work, like tech is going to be instrumental in shaping the future. So yeah, the argument that like politics should be detached and like tech leaders shouldn't weigh in, it's not like the same as pop stars weighing in. It's not like... like, you know, like, oh, a coalition of pop stars against ICE, like, has a very different meaning from, like, tech leaders against ICE, because tech leaders are equipping ICE with the technology they use for their work.
And it's like Hootsuite signing a $2.3 million contract around there with ICE, right? After years of saying they wouldn't do it.
What is Hootsuite going to do for ICE?
Is that still around?
Apparently,
so they can schedule their tweets.
I get, look, I, all I know is I missed that one.
I know Palantir.
Check on that.
Let me, okay, I'll look it up.
You know, Palantir, every single AI frontier lab, Google, you know, like all these companies, yeah, they have huge government contracts. And they're playing more and more of a role in shaping public opinion. How is any of that not political? It's like, yeah.
One thing that I feel like I've learned in the last, 5 years is like, if you cannot make anybody make a statement or take action in the exact same way that's like privately meaningful to you. But if you're questioning whether it's worth saying something or doing something and it's meaningful to you, you should do it. And I think this comes back to the simple thing. If it's meaningful to you to put a sign on your lawn, you should put a sign on your lawn. If it's meaningful to you to wear a pin on your lapel, you should wear a pin. And like my mother-in-law was like, hey, I saw this thing. Like, I don't know if it's on Facebook that like people are going to go out and like hold a candle, like to say that they don't agree with what's going on with ICE. And she's like, well, I went out and I was the only one holding a candle. And maybe I got the time wrong. And also like not everyone saw this Facebook thing. And I was like, well, if it's meaningful to you to hold a candle, you should hold a candle. Like I have a little, I was like, well, I'll put a candle up in my window. So I have these like, I had our like battery powered pillar candles because I had them for the storm. And I just like, I put it in the window. And then I was like, you know what? I kind of like the symbolicness of having a candle in the window. Yeah. And I just left it up. I've had it up for the last 3 days. It's like, I like to have a candle in my window because it means something to me of like, it's a sign of like welcome. And it's a sign of like a light in the darkness. And I think a lot of like a lot of the bad discourse or online is like when people just start to attack other people's sacred cows just because they're sacred, no matter like how important it might be. So like, well, they shot our guy, so I'm going to make fun of like your guy. And once you enter that territory, it's very hard to get out. And I think like you have to allow people to do things that are privately meaningful to them without it needing to be a huge like movement or a referendum on saying the exact right thing or doing the exact right thing.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of tech leaders are about to learn the hard way how embarrassing it is to go along with the latest trend. Because I mean, at the end of the day, I'll always give like a David Sachs more credit than like a Jason Calacanis or, you know, a Mark Zuckerberg or frankly, right now, Sam Altman. Like David Sachs may have extreme views and probably I personally do not believe what he believes, but like he believes it. And he's been on that side consistently and he's fighting for it. Whereas like Mark Zuckerberg, like, you know, Meta's policy changes over the years. He's just going from one side to the other. And, you know, I just think that ends up looking really embarrassing. And especially as those timelines of the vibe shifts are getting shorter and shorter, it's like, oh, you're flip-flopping every 2 years now. Like it just goes to show there's no spine whatsoever. And like, it's just so cynical. And if you're trying to align with whoever's on top, but whoever's on top is not there for very long, you're not going to be able, like, I don't know. It's the same with Daria. Like he's been very consistent with his beliefs, and Anthropic has gotten a lot of pushback in the last couple of years for being like the woke AI company, but they stuck with it. And frankly, if you look at the business model, like they're thriving, which disproves this whole idea that you need to kiss the ring of the administration in order to thrive in this business environment. Like Anthropic is currently leading in market share in enterprise LLMs. Like they, Claude Code has been like the most viral AI product of the last year. Like they're kind of winning, and it's like they're winning despite going against the grain of what's currently popular. So I don't know. Be yourself is the answer.
Let me say really quick, fact check this Hootsuite thing. So there's some conflicting things, but it's not untrue. So in 2020, they had approved a 3-year contract. Employees protested. 2 employees got laid off as part of that, but then Hootsuite decided to cut the contract. Now I'm seeing some conflicting numbers, but they have signed some contract. I'm seeing one place that says they've taken on $95,000 USD, it's a Canadian company, in contracts to conduct social media sentiment analysis for ICE. They're seeking more business. Huh. This other report is saying that the DHS has committed $1.1 million USD and spent more than $454,000, could be worth up to nearly $2.8 million. So the numbers are a little cloudy here. I don't know who to trust, but there was Hootsuite did try to partner with ICE in 2020. People protested. They pulled it, and now they have reneged on that.
Social media sentiment tracking. Yeah. I did not know that was their service, but that's a valuable service in this day and age.
Certainly for ICE.
Julia, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Did you have something else you wanted to say? I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say I'm bullish on Hootsuite. That's how I'd like to conclude.
All right.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Listener, we'll see you next week.